ahead and mark 904 in your songbooks. Sing that here shortly. It's good to come together once again, obviously on a pretty wet day out there, but I said something to Alex as I was taking him home this afternoon about did he have his ark built yet, and then I got to thinking about it. God kind of promised that that would never happen again, so I don't guess we need to build that ark. But anyway, this evening I want to bring you a lesson that some of you may have heard here. I'm not sure. I think sometimes I get in a bad habit of not putting when I preach a lesson again, and I can't remember if I preached this lesson again. I don't know if that goes with age or what, but if it does, it does. But I think I preached this one here in 2011, so some of you may have heard it, some of you may not have. But needless to say, hopefully it's one that we can all use and hear again and take to heart and make application. The basis for the lesson comes from Luke chapter 14, so you can go ahead and turn there. First 11 verses. I won't read that at this point, but that'll be the basis for our lesson this evening. One of the check marks that we as parents should check off is that of teaching our children manners. I think from the time that kids are old enough to talk, all of us who have had kids or have kids have spent countless hours teaching them manners. To say please, to say thank you. Don't talk with your mouth full. Don't butt in line in front of others. And other habits that will really aid them when it comes to being the type of people they should be later in life. Those of you who read or have read the Sunday paper have probably seen the column in there from a lady by the name of Miss Manners. If you aren't familiar with this, people write into the column. They ask her pretty much anything from which fork to eat with, to how to handle a combative relative at the holidays or at a wedding or case may be. Some of them can be quite amusing. And anyway, Miss Manners in real life is a lady by the name of Judith Martin. And she really has, I guess, quite a line of credentials that qualify her. I guess you could say it qualifies her to answer these questions. She grew up in Washington, D.C. and lived in many foreign capitals during her childhood because her father was an economist for the United Nations, so she moved around a lot. Before becoming involved with this syndicated article, she was a film and movie critic. She was a journalist. She covered social events at the White House and foreign embassies. So she's regarded by many as being an expert on social etiquette. Etiquette is defined as a customary code of polite behavior in public. But I think, as we all know, there's other people out there that have differing opinions on different things, and in this case there are some other people that have some rules of etiquette. I know you all have heard of and know of Jay Leno, the comedian who I think just retired here recently from the Tonight Show, and he offered some tips of his own as far as it came to etiquette when attending weddings. Jay says politely waiting in the receiving line for 10 minutes to kiss the bride is good etiquette. Kissing the bride for 10 minutes is bad etiquette. The guests placing their gifts by the sign reading gift table, that's good etiquette, putting them in the right place. The groom placing the gifts by the sign reading yard sale would not be good etiquette. The bride and groom thanking Uncle Harold for his check, that's good etiquette. But when they ask Uncle Harold for two forms of ID before accepting the check, well, not so good. But all humor aside, etiquette is an important part of living in the world that we live in. And we know that there are rules for all sorts of things. So I started with the idea of etiquette because in our text today, here in Luke chapter 14, it appears that Jesus has something to say about proper etiquette during meals. We see him in Luke 14 giving seating instructions at a dinner party. For a child of God, where is the proper place to sit when you're invited to a dinner? So let's turn to Luke 14, and I think we probably are already there, and I want to read that. It says there, "Now it happened as he went into the house of one of the rulers of the Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath, that they watched him closely. And behold, there was a certain man before him who had dropsy. And Jesus, answering, spoke to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? But they kept silent. And he took him and healed him and let him go. Then he answered them, saying, Which of you, having a donkey or an ox that has fallen into a pit, will not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath day? And they could not answer him regarding these things. So he told a parable to those who were invited, when he noted how close they chose the best, or how they chose the best places, saying to them, When you are invited by anyone to a wedding feast, do not sit down in the best place, lest one more honorable than you be invited by him. And he who invited you and him come and say to you, Give place to this man, and then you begin with shame to take the lowest place. But when you are invited, go and sit down in the lowest place, so that he may say to you, Friend, go up higher. Then you will have glory in the presence of those who sit at the table with you. For whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Then he also said to him who invited him, When you give a dinner or a supper, do not ask your friends, your brothers, your relatives, nor rich neighbors, lest they also invite you back, and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed, because they cannot repay you. For you shall be repaid at the resurrection of the just." I think I read a few extra verses, but I think they probably kind of apply to the thought too. Jesus here was invited to the house of one of the leaders of the Pharisees for this meal. Now, I think we all know from our studies that the Pharisees and Jesus weren't exactly on real good terms. They weren't exactly best buds, I guess you could say. So you really got to wonder why in the world they invited Jesus to come there in the first place. It'd be like Donald Trump getting invited to a Democratic fundraiser. Well, anyway, maybe Jesus got invited because he was popular. We all know that with the people. For various reasons, he was popular, some good, some bad. Maybe it was like one of those dinners that was attended by the religious who's who of Jerusalem, or the religious elite, so he was invited for that reason. You know, in that case, everybody who was anybody would have been there, so that makes sense. And even if the Pharisees didn't like Jesus, having dinner with him would have raised their popularity with the people because he was the most popular person around. But really, I think the text here gives us a real good clue as to the real reason why they invited Jesus. This meal was held on the Sabbath, and Luke tells us that they watched him closely. Now, they weren't watching Jesus because they wanted to learn from him or use his example. Rather, they were watching him because they were trying to find him doing something wrong. They'd already tried to trip him up before when they were condemning him because he plucked grain on the Sabbath. In other words, was working on the Sabbath. We found that earlier in Scripture. But they'd failed miserably there, and you'd have thought they'd have learned. But maybe here they thought this opportunity might give them a better chance. Here in their own houses on the Sabbath, they could kind of monitor everything that Jesus said and did and maybe find one action or word that they could use to convict him. And sure enough, Jesus didn't let them down. In waiting for dinner to be served, we see this man that's brought to him with this condition that they call, I think it's dropsy. I may have called it dropsy earlier, I don't know. But anyway, from kind of looking that up, it kind of goes a lot with a condition today called edema, which is a disease that, for different reasons, fluids gather under the skin, so you kind of swell up. But really, we don't know why this man was brought in. Whether he was invited by the Pharisees or whether they pulled him in off the streets, we really don't know. And he could have been a plant, for all we know. But Jesus did exactly what the Pharisees hoped that he would do. He healed this man on the Sabbath, proving to those religious leaders that Jesus was a rabbi who had no regard for the law and their traditions. Jesus, as he always does, though, uses this real-life situation to make a spiritual point. He knows his audience, he knows what they're thinking, and he makes this point via that particular information. These people prided themselves in their rank and the observance of every tidbit of the law. And yet Jesus is about to teach them a much deeper point. Righteousness is more than following a bunch of rules. Righteousness involves weightier matters, matters of the heart like humility, service, love, and forgiveness. So as things begin to settle down and the guests make their way to the dinner table, Jesus notices something. They're all jockeying for position at the head of the table. The places of honor are filling up quickly. And most likely the places of greatest honor in that day would be very similar to what we see today. The seats around or closest to the host of the party would be the ones that fill up first. So Jesus takes this opportunity to teach a lesson, and that really leads us to verse 7 of chapter 14 here. But I think I realize it's only human nature for us, each one of us, to want the best seat in the house. You think about sporting events, and you think about skybox seats. Anymore, those things can go for thousands of dollars. You think of seats on the 50-yard line at a football game. You think of ringside seats at a boxing match, or the lower level seats right behind the bench at a basketball game. And I think we all know that people fork out big money for those seats. They seem to have because they have the best views, they have the most costly ticket prices. But also, I think it's interesting that they carry the biggest bragging potential as well. I've had people in years past stick tickets in front of my face and go, I paid $300 a piece for these. And I'm like, wow, what could you have done with that $300 as to getting a ticket? Because you can sit in front of the television set anymore and get a better seat than you can sitting there at the game, even though you're not in person. But as we see here, it impresses people when we tell them that we have the best seats. This desire for the best seat in the house shows up in other places as well. All you have to do is go to a parking lot at a mall, or go to Walmart even, which I was just there recently. Didn't get the opportunity, or didn't take the opportunity, to drive around the parking lot for 10 or 15 minutes to try to get closer to the building. I just parked way out at the end and walked. But all you have to do besides going there is come by the store that I work at and watch people park right in front of the front door when it's raining or snowing outside, because they don't want to get wet and they don't want to take a few extra steps. So they get right there in front of the door where people can't even hardly go in and out. It's pretty interesting. But really, as we can see and as we know, no one wants that place far away or at the end of the lot. So when they went to worship, the Jews themselves had the best seats in the synagogues. And Jesus made mention of them when he said in Matthew 23, verse 6, they love the best places at feasts, the best seats in the synagogues. As in most church buildings today, the synagogues, like those, typically had raised platforms up front where the worship leaders would sit. And so visiting rabbis and other people that would come in would often participate by reading or by speaking, and those people would sit up front on those raised platforms. So it was an honor to have one of these seats. These, in fact, were the best seats in the house. We also have best seats in the church building, but sometimes it's a little different with us, and I get a little tickled sometimes. Seems like the best seats, when it comes to today, seem to be in the back. And I think we've got it all wrong when that's the case. But needless to say, that's what happens. In Mark 10, we read of two apostles of Jesus, James and John. And they were trying to get this into this best seat thing. Excuse me. Basically, there they were saying, Jesus, we want the best seats in the kingdom. We want the places of honor, prestige, and power. And I think that's a natural response. We all want the best seats. But back to our text, Jesus here in Luke 14 teaches a profound concept to us in verses 8 through 11. I want to reread that. He says there, when you're invited by anyone to a wedding feast, do not sit down in the best place, lest one more honorable than you be invited by him. And he who invited you and him come and say to you, give place to this man, and then you begin with shame to take the lowest place. But when you're invited, go and sit down in the lowest place, so that when he who invited you comes, he may say to you, friend, go up higher. Then you will have glory in the presence of those who sit at the table with you. For whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. It's easy for us to picture this scenario here that Jesus describes. You go to a wedding reception, and you decide you'll take a seat right next to the bride and groom. What's going to happen? It's not going to be very long until you've got somebody walking up to you and saying, those are reserved. You need to move. And so with that, you're going to feel kind of foolish because you've got to get up and you got to move somewhere else. And probably by that point in time, the only other place you're going to be able to go is at the back of the building in the corner where nobody else is sitting. Because as we've already talked about, people are going to get the best seats they can. So it kind of goes as to how he's saying it here. It fits. Jesus tells us, though, to take the lower seat, to humble ourselves, so that when we are offered, or when we take those lower seats, we can be offered the front seat. And at that point, we will be honored. This is an application that I think we all have trouble with. Jesus tells us here to humble yourself and be exalted. But if we exalt ourselves, which we tend to do, we're going to end up being humbled. And really, that's tough for all of us to put into practice, because all of us can be prideful, and I'm including myself in that. It's a problem, I think, that we all struggle with, and those things that go along with pride: conceit, selfishness, arrogance, egotism. I love a quote that I found a while back that went like this. Someone said, egotism is the only disease that when you've got it, it makes somebody else sick. And I think we can all see that or have seen that. If you remember Muhammad Ali, he was probably the best, greatest boxer of all time. The only problem was Muhammad Ali knew it. And there was a story told of Ali getting on a plane one time. He was about to take off. The flight attendant comes up to him and says, sir, you'll have to buckle your seatbelt. Ali, in his typical brass showmanship manner, looks at her and says, Superman don't need a seatbelt. She responded, Superman don't need an airplane either. And Ali buckled his seatbelt. Well, I'm really not picking on him, but the truth of the matter is, pride is very easy to see in others, but it's not really easy to see in ourselves. Jesus says, for everyone who exalts himself shall be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Start humbly and God will move you up. Start arrogantly and God will take you down. If you don't believe this, then just go back to a passage that we studied not too long ago in Daniel chapter 4, And look what happened to Nebuchadnezzar. It's obvious that what Jesus is teaching here is the opposite of nearly everything that we hear today about success. Every motivational speaker out there, and I don't know if you've ever heard any, I've only heard one or two in my time in the business world, they're going to tell you to go out there and tell people about yourself, toot your own horn, bang your own drum, wave your credentials around, let everybody know who you are so you can move up. There was a man by the name of Robert Ringer a few years ago that wrote a best-selling book called Looking Out for Number One. People turned out in droves just to get this book. Why? Well, it told them what they wanted to hear and what they already knew was the case in the society that we live in. He said, you take care of yourself because no one else will. But Jesus says that the path to success in his kingdom comes through humility. So he tells them, when you're invited, go sit in the lowest place. And I think it's fairly obvious that Jesus had more in mind than just seating arrangements here at wedding feast. He was speaking here of each one of us and how we live our daily lives. He's saying, take the back burner, take the last seat willingly, because in doing that, God will exalt you. Many people become discouraged trying to follow this particular teaching of Jesus. Because there are times, because of that we don't see a promotion. People don't recognize the good works that we do or the good character that we have. If we let ourselves fall to these devices, though, we're totally missing the point. The promotions we will receive are not of this world. Jesus doesn't want us to worry at all about what seat we're in. Don't worry about being important or honored or the person on top. Well, that goes totally against our culture, doesn't it? There's a quote which is sometimes attributed to Vince Lombardi, but actually a man by the name of Redgers was the one that came up with this. He once said, and I know you've heard this, winning isn't everything, it's the only thing. This is the driving force behind sports today. But the problem with that is when we try to apply that philosophy to our daily lives, things don't work so well. Jesus says in Mark 9, verse 35, if anyone wants to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all. And that really doesn't sound like a winning formula, does it? You probably won't find it listed in the 10 most important habits of successful people, because our culture says go for first, but our Lord says no, go for last. This attitude is a basic piece of the foundation that's vital for the church to be unified. Philippians 2 verses 3 through 8 says, let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant and coming in the likeness of men. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. What better way to teach our children about humility than the example we as parents portray to them in our day-to-day lives? Do we gripe about the small things that we have to do in our job and say, those are somebody else's responsibility? Guilty, I've done that. Do they see us doing the small, insignificant, and yet important tasks within the church, whether we ourselves have time to do those or not? Do we expect to be recognized for those things? It's extremely important that we talk to our children about faith, but it's just as important, and even possibly more important, that we demonstrate to them our faith in example. I've observed over the years that by and large, the children who remain faithful after they leave the home are those who've seen their parents being active and doing things in the ministry. Actions speak louder than words, and that's so true. Would Jesus' commands on humility have been effective without him himself lowering himself to become that perfect lamb of sacrifice for us? Dave Thomas, founder of Wendy's Restaurants, achieved success despite the fact that the guy never graduated from high school. I can remember I worked for Kentucky Fried Chicken at one point in time, and I didn't realize it for years, but that's where he started out, was with Kentucky Fried Chicken, and then he shot off and he founded the Wendy's restaurant chains that we all know today. They're all over the country. I assume there's probably some in other countries as well. But anyway, this guy never graduated from high school. But he writes in one of his books, "I guarantee you that I'm the only founder among America's big companies whose picture in the corporate annual report shows him wielding a mop in a plastic bucket." He makes it clear that that wasn't a gag. It was a case of leading by example. Mr. Thomas says that every employee in Wendy's should get their MBA. Only to Dave Thomas, an MBA doesn't mean a master's of business administration. It means a mop bucket attitude, a willingness to do whatever needs to be done, no matter how lowly that may seem. There's plenty of ways to earn our MBA in the church. Look around what needs done, no matter how small. It might be time consuming, it might be dirty, it might be hot, it might be a job that requires a lot of effort. If you can't find anything, you're not looking low enough. Sometimes it looks like there's nothing to do in the church because we only want to do the things that get us recognized for what we do by others. And if we do that, are we any different than these people in Luke chapter 14 that are jockeying for seats? An admirer once asked famous orchestra conductor Leonard Bernstein, what was the most difficult instrument to play? He said, second fiddle. He said, I can get plenty of first violinists, but to find someone who wants to play second violin with as much enthusiasm, or second French horn, or second flute, now that's a problem. But if no one plays second, we have no harmony. It's so true. May our lives be filled with an overwhelming desire to live lives that are truly Christ-like. May the qualities of service, sacrifice, and submission be evident in all of us. We don't have to worry about what seat we're in here. God's promise that everyone who's obedient will be promoted to first chair in heaven. Are you living the way that you should? Have you become obedient to his will? If not, we're already here to help you in any way as we stand and as we sing the song that Eric selected.
Have you been to